Speaking of the stomach bug, it's interesting. It hit our house this week. We had two of our five that came down with it during the week. And it's funny how God works things out sometimes. Our youngest, he's six. He was the second one to get it. He didn't eat all day, one whole day. And we knew something was kind of wrong because that's very unusual for him. I mean, the kid eats every 2 hours normally. He didn't eat all day. Well, then the next day is when things became apparent, what was going on. Well, he didn't eat all that day either. And so by Friday night, the kid hadn't eaten, I don't know, six to eight meals, something like that. And he comes to me with tears in his eyes. Dad, I'm so hungry. So hungry. Can I eat something? And I had to say to him, son, I'm sorry, I can't. I can't give you anything. Last Sunday, we talked about God disciplining the nation of Israel. We looked at Deuteronomy chapter 8, where God says to them, I let you go hungry to test you, to teach you, to humble you. And I asked the question, would I ever withhold food from my kid? Now, it was a different context. But here I found myself saying to my son, I'm sorry, I can't. And I think what God was telling me was, he takes no pleasure in the withholding. It's not the disciplining that God wants. It's not that he wants to discipline us. I mean, he wants to discipline us because of the result that it brings in our lives. Just as it hurt me to say to my son, I can't give you any food. And yet God's heart is for us that we would share in his holiness. And so there are times when God maybe withholds things from us, keeps things from us. But it's not because he takes pleasure in the withholding. I'm sure it grieves him. He wants us to have life. He wants us to experience life and have it to the full. How do we do that? God desires for us to know him. He desires for us to love him. He desires for us to be like him. And that is where we find real life. The more we are like him, the more that we love him, the more that we know him, that's where we find life. That's what God is offering. This is what God was offering to the nation of Israel. This is what God offers to us. Jesus says this in John chapter 17. And this is eternal life, that they may know you, the only true God, and Jesus Christ, whom you have sent. That's where we find real life. In knowing God. Now, how does he do that? How do we do that? It's not simply having knowledge of God. Right? We can read theology books, but that doesn't mean you know God. Well, just like God did with the nation of Israel, sometimes he brings things into our lives to teach us things. I learned something about God this week. Telling my son that he can't have any food. God's heart is for us. And sometimes he withholds things because it's for our benefit, right? But God uses experience in our... Excuse me. Puberty all over again. God uses experiences in our lives to teach us those things, to help us to understand who he is and what he wants, what he's all about, to bring us in conformity to who he is so that we can experience the life that he has for us. And we've been studying Deuteronomy chapter 30, looking at the offer that Moses gave to the Israelites as they were about to enter the promised land. Once again, God brought Israel out of Egypt. He redeemed them. He bought them. He brought them out of slavery, brought them up to the edge of the promised land, and said, now, here's what I have to offer you. And that generation rebelled against God and they rejected what he said. They said, no, we're not willing to do what you ask us to do. And so God took that generation back out into the wilderness for 40 years. And He used that time to bring up this next generation, to teach them, to train them, to discipline them, so that now we come to the point where they're once again at the edge of the promised land. And God offers to them, now, here's what I offer you, life in this promised land, this land of blessing, this land flowing with milk and honey. And so Moses once again is standing with this group of people and saying, here's what God is offering, life. But you also have the option of choosing death. God leaves it up to you. And so we found in Deuteronomy chapter 30, starting in verse 15, Moses offers them this. See, I have set before you today life and prosperity and death and adversity. In that I command you today to love the Lord your God, to walk in His ways and to keep His commandments and His statutes and His judgments, that you may live and multiply, and that the Lord your God may bless you in the land where you are entering to possess it. He offered them life and prosperity. How? How are they to have that? Once again, it's to love God, to walk in His ways, to be like Him, keep His commandments and His statutes and His judgments, to know Him, to love Him, and to be like Him. But Moses goes on in verse 17. But if your heart turns away and you will not obey, but are drawn away and worship other gods and serve them, I declare to you today that you shall surely perish. You will not prolong your days in the land where you are crossing the Jordan to enter and possess it. So what is Moses saying now? Well, there's another side to this, folks. On the one hand, there's life and prosperity. On the other hand, there's death and adversity. Well, how do we experience that? If your heart turns away, if you will not obey, if you are drawn away and you worship and serve other gods. What is Moses doing? It's like he's putting out some road signs. You ever driving down the road and you see a sign that says, like, lane ends 2,000 feet, and then there's another sign that says lane ends 1,500 feet. Another sign that says lane ends 1,000. You get the idea, they're trying to tell you something? Well, here's Moses putting up some signs. Dead end. Don't go that way. This road ends in death. Boy, that's pretty. Wouldn't you like to see that sign? Road ends in death. I think I would turn on that road or away from that road. A few weeks ago, we looked at this very briefly, overview. Verse 16, Moses lays out some things for the people to consider. Life and prosperity comes from from loving God, from walking in His ways, and from keeping His commandments. We then looked at verse 17 where he talks about their heart and their obedience and their worship and their service of God. And we recognize that there is a connection between these. Love is to be from the heart. Walking, obedience is to be from the heart. It's not something we simply do on the outside. Keeping His commandments. All of this is tied up with worshiping and serving God, which is something that we are called to do. There is a connection here. It's all together. The heart and obedience and worship and walking in God's ways. They're all connected together. And this morning, we're going to look at death. Death and adversity. Now, I originally wanted to title this, How to Choose Death, but Paul said I should probably not do that. Might have the wrong connotations to it. And so we'll simply ask the question, well, how do we avoid death? Again, Moses laid it out for the people and says, you have this choice. Choose life or choose death. Well, how do we avoid choosing death? Once again, let's look at verse 17. And here's what Moses said. I'll read it one more time. But if your heart turns away and you will not obey, but are drawn away and worship other gods and serve them. What does he say? If your heart turns away. Again, the idea here is that we are to be following God with our hearts, loving God with all of your heart, soul, mind, and strength. That's what God longs for from each and every one of us. That we would love Him from the heart. God also desires, we saw this last week quite a bit, God desires that we would fear Him. Both of these, love for God and fear of God, are tied together. And both of these would then prompt us to be obedient to God. If I truly love God, I will do the things that please God and do the things that He wants me to do. If I truly fear God, I understand who He is, that as Creator, as Sustainer, as the majestic, holy God, He deserves my obedience and my worship. And so tied up with those is the fear of the Lord, prompting us to be obedient, to do things His way. Not only that, but God knows the right way to do things. He designed life. He invented it. So why not do it the way that He intended it to be? Moses told us, love the Lord your God with all your heart. We also saw that God said of the Israelites, when they heard the voice of God, and they said to Moses, please, we can't bear to hear that anymore. God is too holy for us. You go to God. You hear what He has to say, and then you come and tell us. And does God condemn them for that? Does He scold them for that? No, in fact, He says, oh, that they had such a heart in them that they would fear Me and keep all My commandments always. They demonstrated the proper fear of the Lord when they recognized His holiness and they were afraid to approach Him. And God says, oh, that they had such a heart. The heart is the center of who we are. It's the inner part of all of us, of each of us. And we are to love God and to follow God and to fear God with all of that, with all of who we are. Walt Kaiser, he's an Old Testament scholar. He says this, in Deuteronomy, the fear of the Lord went hand in hand with keeping His commands, walking after Him, serving Him, loving Him, and cleaving to Him. Thus, to fear the Lord was to love Him, to cleave to Him, and to serve Him. He goes on to say this, to fear Yahweh was to commit oneself to Yahweh in faith. When we recognize who He is and recognize that He has what is right and good in mind for us, then we respond to Him in faith and accept what He says. This fear was a guiding principle for every aspect of life and for as long as one lives on the earth. It included the believer's obedience, love, loyalty, and worship. So once again, Moses is calling upon the people, don't let your hearts turn away from God. If you allow your hearts to turn away from God, the result is death. But following God with all of your hearts requires you to act in faith and to accept what God says and to act on it. We know we have a tendency to disobey and to walk away. God knows this. Moses knew this. But if your heart turns away and you will not obey, but are drawn away and worship other gods and serve them, drawn away. The word means to be led astray or driven away like sheep. Imagine a flock of sheep out in the field and something comes and scares them. And they're driven away from where they're supposed to be. That's what God is talking about here with their hearts. If your hearts are driven away, scared off. He uses the same word. Moses uses this word in Deuteronomy 13. And we've got to look at a couple passages there. Deuteronomy 13. If you have a bulletin or something, stick it in chapter 30. We're going to come back to that. But Deuteronomy 13. Here Moses uses the same word, but here in the New American Standard, from this, which is what I'm reading from, they use the word seduce in this passage. Here's what Moses says to the people, starting in verse 1, if a prophet or a dreamer of dreams arises among you and gives you a sign or a wonder, and the sign or the wonder comes true, concerning which he spoke to you, saying, let us go after other gods, whom you have not known, and let us serve them. You shall not listen to the words of that prophet or that dreamer of dreams, for the Lord your God is testing you to find out if you love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul. You shall not follow the Lord, you shall follow the Lord your God and fear him, and you shall keep his commandments, listen to his voice, serve him, and cling to him. But that prophet or that dreamer of dreams shall be put to death, because he has counseled rebellion against the Lord your God, who brought you from the land of Egypt and redeemed you from the house of slavery, to seduce you from the way in which the Lord your God commanded you to walk. So you shall purge the evil from among you. Again, he uses that word in verse 13, talking about worthless men who have gone out and seduced the people from following God. Well, who are some of the people that might try to do this to us, to seduce us? Well, here he says it's a prophet or a dreamer of dreams. Someone who claims to be a prophet of God and yet has a message that is contrary to the message that God has already given to the people. Even if he has a sign or a wonder, some sort of a miracle that he puts forward as proof of what he's saying. If it doesn't match up with what God has already said, then you dismiss that man. And not only dismiss him, what are you supposed to do to them? Purge the evil from Israel. Who else might do this? Well, he says in verse 6, if your brother, your mother's son or daughter, or the wife you cherish, or your friend who is as your own soul, entice you secretly, saying, let us go and serve other gods, whom neither you nor your fathers have known. It could even be someone who's a member of your own family. It might not be someone who's out there. It might be someone who's really close. What if it's someone that you love who says to you, hey, let's go worship another god. Let's go serve this other god. What are you supposed to do with that person? Verse 8, you shall not yield to him or listen to him, and your eyes shall not pity him, nor shall you spare or conceal him, but you shall surely kill him. Even if it's the wife you cherish? You shall surely kill him. Your hand shall be the first against him to put him to death, and afterwards the hand of all the people. So you shall stone him to death because he has sought to seduce you from the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. Then all Israel will hear and be afraid and will never again do such a wicked thing among you. Do you think God takes this seriously? Do you think this might be something important in God's grand scheme of things? I am very glad that we don't live under that system. We have freedom. We are free from this law, and praise God for that. But the point is, God expects us to worship and serve him, to not be seduced, to not be drawn away, to not be led astray by someone, even if it sounds really good. Even if he has some sort of proof or confirmation, if it doesn't match with what God has already said, then do not listen to it. It's a test, in fact, God says, to see if you really love God. If you really will fear him and honor him and obey him. Back to Deuteronomy 30. But if your heart turns away and you will not obey, but are drawn away and worship other gods and serve them. Worship other gods and serve them. You want to have some fun? Well, I think this is fun. I love using some of these online Bible programs. One of my favorites is very simple to use, BibleGateway.com. I went to BibleGateway.com and I typed in their little search bar, worship, serve. It's amazing how many times those two words appear in the same verse throughout Scripture. Worship and serve, worship and serve, worship and serve. In fact, this was a common theme that God kept stressing to the nation of Israel over and over and over again. You are to worship me and serve me only. Don't worship and serve other gods. Don't be drawn away and worship and serve other gods. Especially, he mentions the stars in heaven and the sun and the moon. Don't be drawn away and worship and serve them. And what did Israel do? Worship and serve other gods. Don't be led astray by the people who are in the land, because they're going to lead you away from worshiping and serving me, and they're going to lead you to worship and serve their gods, and they're going to try to incorporate their worship with your worship. Don't let it happen. And what did they do? They did it. Even to the point where they were sacrificing their own children. How could that be even thought of in worshiping God? And yet they were seduced and drawn away. Deuteronomy chapter 5. Moses is giving the law, restating the law to the people, the Ten Commandments that God had delivered to them from the mountain in Exodus 20. And God gives them, Moses is reminding them of the law. And he says, starting in verse 6, once again, God says, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt. Do you know how many times God says that in the Old Testament? That's another fun one to look up. Reminding them who he is. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. What is he saying? I am the Lord your God. We could also understand this. The grammar would allow this translation as well. I, the Lord, am your God. So he's saying to this group of people, these Israelites, I am the God who led you out of Egypt. That God, remember that God? That's me. I'm the one who did that. No other God did that. I did it. I am that God. And so what's God doing? You familiar with the phrase or the little acronym DTR? Did anybody? Was that just a New Jersey thing? In high school, you know when you're kind of like, you know, you're hanging out with a member of the opposite sex and you're it's kind of like this weird thing, like you don't really know what's happening. Y'all never heard this before? Okay, good. So DTR means define the relationship, right? There comes a point when you got to start, okay, what are we doing here, right? This is God reminding them, defining the relationship. Remember, I'm the God who brought you out of Egypt. That's me. Nobody else. Me. And you, Israel, has a relationship with me and with nobody else. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. Therefore, verse 7, you shall have no other gods before me. Right? Why does he keep stressing the fact that he brought them out of Israel? Brought them out of Egypt? Why? What does that demonstrate? The fact that God brought them out of Egypt. What do you think? What does that demonstrate to the people of Israel? They belong to him. He set them free from bondage. He has power to save. Certainly he demonstrated his power over all the gods of Egypt, right? What else? What about God himself? What might that demonstrate? He's the one that wants to be worshipped. He did. He gave him the Passover. Sorry? He initiated it. God, exactly. God is the one who initiated the relationship. I think it demonstrates, here are some things that I thought of. Certainly it demonstrates God's love. He didn't leave them in slavery. He didn't leave them in bondage. It demonstrates his mercy. Surely his compassion for his people. He says to Moses, I have heard the cry of these people and I want to bring them out. His faithfulness. Why? Well, because he promised. He actually told Abraham that this was all going to happen 400 years before. your people, all your descendants are going to go to Egypt, and they're going to be there for 400 years, and I'm going to bring them out after that. His power, as we talked about, his authority. One of the things that God was doing over the other gods was demonstrating his authority over all these supposed gods that Egypt had. His foreknowledge. He told this all happening way ahead of time. In fact, in the book of Deuteronomy alone, this idea, this concept, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, it's repeated 8 times in the book of Deuteronomy. God was really trying to get some point across to them. And so he says, because I am your God, because that God, remember that? Because I am your God, you shall have no other gods before me. This was a call to faithfulness to those people. I think in that call, there is also a certain obligation. I bought you. I own you. Matthew chapter 4 is the temptation of Christ. And one of the temptations, one of the things that Satan says to him is, just bow down and worship me. Would you do that? Come on, you can do that. Come on. And what is Jesus' response? You shall worship the Lord your God and serve him only. Where does he get that from? Book of Deuteronomy. God says, continuing on, you shall not make for yourselves an idol or any likeness of what is in heaven above or on the earth beneath or in the water under the earth. You shall not worship them or serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children, on the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing loving kindness to thousands, to those who love me and keep my commandments. You shall not make for yourselves an idol or any likeness. Why? Nothing physical could represent God's majesty or transcendence. Anything that is a physical representation of God is by definition not God. God is other than anything created. And so anything that is created could not represent God and is therefore a false understanding, a false view of God. Anything less than God, anything other than God is less than God. And so we are to have no physical representations of God. You shall not worship them or serve them. Again, this is a big thing for God. Worship and service are expected between any God and its people. I'm sure many of you have been in other cultures around the world where this is just a normal course of life, is it not? If a people has gods, they are supposed to do something for those gods. There's some means for them to interact with those gods. We are wired this way. We were born for this, to worship and serve the one true God. What's the problem, though? Romans 1, Paul tells us that even though we know that God is really there, that he's really the God that is there, we want to worship and serve the creatures, the creation, rather than the creation, or excuse me, the creator. And Paul even uses those words, worship and serve. Again, we're hardwired there. We will worship and serve something. And God is constantly reminding us, make sure it's really me. And not a God that you have invented or some perversion of who God is. Some false understanding of who he is. What if they were to do this? Again, Deuteronomy 30, verse 17. But if your heart turns away and you will not obey, but are drawn away and worship other gods and serve them, I declare to you today that you shall surely perish. The word perish has to do with destruction or ruin. Are you familiar with the name Abaddon? It's mentioned in the book of Revelation. It means the one who is the destroyer. It's related to this word in Hebrew. This may remind us also of Genesis 2, when God says to Adam, "Do not eat from the tree that is in the middle of the garden, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil." Why? Because in the day you eat of it, you will surely die. Now there, God uses a different word. That one means the end of life or separation. And so what is God communicating through all of this? Well, there's a lot riding on this. Again, the wages of sin is always death. Whether it's physical, whether it's separation, whether it's ruin or destruction, it always goes the wrong way. And so we need to be doing things the right way, God's way. That's a lot of Old Testament stuff, right? Well, we're different now because we're a New Testament. We're going to go into a time of communion right now. And as we do that, I want us to look at 1 Corinthians chapter 11 and see perhaps something that may fit with what God is talking about in the Old Testament. 1 Corinthians 11, Paul wrote the book of Corinthians, the letter of Corinthians, to correct a lot of their bad ideas and to answer a lot of their questions. And so we come to chapter 11, and he says in verse 17, "But in giving this instruction," it's like he's going down a list of questions or things that they had, and he's answering each one. "Now, let me get to this one," he says. "In giving this instruction, I do not praise you, because you come together not for the better, but for the worse. For in the first place, when you come together as a church, I hear that divisions exist among you, and in part I believe it. For there must also be factions among you, so that those who are proved may become evident among you. Therefore, when you meet together, it is not to eat the Lord's Supper. For in your eating, each one takes his own supper first, and one is hungry and another is drunk. What? Do you not have houses in which to eat and drink? Or do you despise the church of God and shame those who have nothing? What shall I say to you? Shall I praise you in this? In this I will not praise you." What was the problem here? There was a whole lot of disunity in this church. They were kind of messed up. Now their communion, their service was probably a little bit different from ours. Theirs included a whole meal. And it was potluck. And so those who had means would bring something to eat. And those who perhaps didn't have means, they would come expecting to eat. But apparently the problem was that the people who brought the food ate the food, and the other people who didn't have anything didn't have anything. And in fact, Paul says that some of you are even getting drunk at these services. That would be a problem. There was disunity in the church. And now Paul goes into, well, let me deal with this problem, he says. And then we have the passage that everyone likes to read for communion services. "For I received from the Lord," verse 23, "that which I delivered to you, that the Lord Jesus, in the night in which he was betrayed, took bread, and when he had given thanks, he broke it and said, 'This is my body, which is for you. Do this in remembrance of me.' In the same way, he took the cup after supper, saying, 'This cup is the new covenant in my blood. Do this as often as you drink it in remembrance of me. For as often as you eat this bread and drink this cup, you proclaim the Lord's death until he comes.'" So that's a real nice thing to think about. But think about the context in which we find this. He just scolded them for their disunity in the church. Now he's talking about communion. Now he goes on from there. What's the solution to this problem? Verse 27, "Therefore, whoever eats the bread or drinks the cup of the Lord in an unworthy manner shall be guilty of the body and blood of the Lord. But a man must examine himself, and in so doing he is to eat of the bread and drink of the cup. For he who eats and drinks judgment to himself, if he does not judge the body rightly. For this reason, many among you are weak and sick, and a number sleep. But if we judged ourselves rightly, we would not be judged. But when we are judged, we are disciplined by the Lord so that we will not be condemned along with the world." Wow! All that from communion? So what's God's solution? His solution is to discipline people. They were sinning against the rest of the body. And so God says that, Paul says that some of you are weak and sick and a number sleep, meaning you're dead, they're dead. Why? Because they were disrespecting the body. Because they were sinning against the body. And God disciplined them, apparently first, by making some of them weak and sick, and they didn't get it. And it got all the way to the point where some of them had to actually die. That's pretty severe discipline. And yet Paul warns, if we take the time to examine our own hearts, to understand what it is that God is trying to show us about our own hearts, we can avoid this. If we judge ourselves rightly, we will not be judged. We need to be very careful. And then Paul gives an application to this. Verse 33, "So then, my brethren, when you come together to eat, wait for one another." It seems pretty simple, doesn't it? How do I avoid dying as a result of eating communion the wrong way? Wait. Now again, the context was a little different. In the context of that meal, where some were gorging themselves because they brought it, and others were going hungry. The principle is the same though. The principle meaning if there is disunity in the body, if there is disrespect between anyone in the body, then there's a problem. And God is going to discipline it. Why? Because He wants us to share in His holiness. He disciplines us for our good, that we may share in His holiness. He's trying to change us to be the people that He wants us to be. Is there any way, any part of you that has turned away from God, the God who redeemed you? Yeah, He didn't bring you out of Egypt, but He brought you out of the kingdom of darkness. He redeemed you. If you are truly a child of God, He has brought you out. And He calls you to worship and serve Him. Has your heart turned away in any way? Is there anything that you know that God asks you to do and you are not willing to obey it? This is not something to play around with. Do we have any false gods? It may not be some idol that you bow down to in your house. It may even be just false views of the one true God. Do we have false ideas? Are we worshiping a God that we have somehow created in our own minds? And not the God who has revealed Himself through the Scriptures? Any false ideas of worship? Have we manufactured our own worship of this God? Is there anything in your heart that you need to make right with God right now? Maybe the Holy Spirit's bringing something to mind. Maybe there's something that you need to confess right now and deal with right now. I would encourage you right now, take care of that with God. If it's more meaningful to you to come up here and do that, maybe you want to kneel down right here and deal with God. It's not something to play with. Is there anything you need to make right with someone else in this room? Anything between you? We are coming to a time of communion. We can't have communion if there's division. They're mutually exclusive. Again, I would encourage you, maybe you have to get up right now and go and talk to somebody. Is that scary? Yeah, that's scary. But so is being weak and sick and perhaps dying. That's pretty scary too. Make it right, right now. Just want us to take a minute or so and just examine our own hearts. Do I hold anything against someone else? Am I holding on to some false thing, some false God in my heart? Communion is not just us taking a little piece of bread and drinking a little swallow of juice. It's not just this way, it's also this way, as Paul demonstrates here. Just take a moment and deal with this. Gentlemen, if you would come forward and prepare.
King of endless words, no one could express how much you deserve. Though I'm weak and poor, all I have is yours. Every single breath, I'll bring you more than a song. And I'll bring you more than a song. For a song in itself is not what you have required. You search much deeper within. Through the way things appear, you're looking into my heart. I'm coming back to the heart of worship, and it's all about you. It's all about you, Jesus. I'm sorry, Lord, for the thing I've made it, when it's all about you, yeah, it's all about you, Jesus. I'm coming back to the heart of worship, and it's all about you, yeah, it's all about you, Jesus. I'm sorry, Lord, for the thing I've made it, when it's all about you, it's all about you, Jesus.